And hello, Sun Sounds listeners. This is Andy Bobick, which means, once again, it's time for the Children's Story Hour. And as always, I'm glad you could join me today for a good variety of children's stories. Like always, the first half hour, I'll be reading picture books. And then the second half hour, I'm going to continue with a novel that I started last week titled Too Bright to See. But first, so let's begin today's program with the picture book titles. I'm going to start off with a book titled The Sea We Call Home. And then it's William Shakespeare, Twelfth Night. Babar comes to America. And if we have time, I'll finish up the first half hour with I Am Abraham Lincoln. So it should be a lot of fun. Let's get started with our first picture book today titled The Sea We Call Home. Little Knopf and Maribel were going to sea for the very first time, and they were so excited. Little Knopf had been learning from the Big Book of the Sea. "Is the sea still far away?" asked Little Knopf. "Yes," said Maribel, "but it's so amazing because there are sawfish, flying fish, whales, and lots of big white birds." The two travelers became very tired from walking for so long. Then, suddenly, the sea was right there. "Wow," said Little Knopf, "this is like a dream." The bright sky, silky blue water with the golden sun sparkling on the waves were so beautiful. All of a sudden, Maribel was alerted by her magical ears to a strange noise. Little Knopf heard it too. It was crying for help. "Little Knopf, look along the shore." A baby whale was lying on the sand, trapped in a fishing net. "We have to get him into the water. Whales need water to survive," cried Maribel. Little Knopf and Maribel rushed to the baby whale because Knopfs loved the earth and all its creatures. The two friends tried really hard to push the baby whale back into the sea, but the baby was far too heavy for them to move. "Wait for the tide," advised the sand crab, waving his claws. "At high tide, the seawater rises over the shore and then later recedes, which will wash the baby whale back to the sea." "First, we have to free him from this net," decided Little Knopf. "Otherwise, he won't be able to swim." With the help of the sand crab, the two Knopfs used sharp shells to cut the ropes free. Then they were startled by a loud sound. Whoosh! "The whoosh sound came from a big whale," shouted Little Knopf. He learned in the Big Book of the Sea that whales breathe by spouting air through a hole on their backs. The huge whale emerged, leaving a giant spray of seawater behind. The baby whale whimpered. He wanted to find his mommy. The two Knopfs worked quickly, but the baby whale was getting weaker and weaker. He barely moved, and his eyes were closing. "Hold on, little whale," Maribel pleaded. "I have an idea," cried Little Knopf. "Seagulls, we need your help." The Knopfs made long ropes from pieces of net. The seagulls pulled hard on the ropes, lifting the baby towards the sea. "Don't be afraid, little whale," Maribel whispered, stroking its back. Once the baby was in the water, Little Knopf and Maribel removed the nets and thanked the seagulls. The Knopfs knew the baby whale needed to swim to survive, so they climbed on his back and encouraged him to move. "Swim, baby whale," said Maribel. "Move your tail," cried the little Knopf. The baby whale couldn't swim. Then a secret song, which only Knopfs and whales could hear, rose from the depths of the water. "Your mommy is calling you, little whale. Please swim," begged Maribel. The baby whale slightly opened his eyes, wiggled its tail a little, and finally started to swim. Phew! It was a bumpy ride as the baby whale dove into the sea. When they reached the mother whale, the baby snuggled up against her, happy at last. Mommy whale was so happy to have her baby safe, she sang a joyful song that sent shivers through the sea. Then mother and baby dove deeper into the sea, taking both Nofs with them. Fish and sea creatures of all sizes and colors came to greet the three friends. There were starfish, seahorses, and even giant turtles. What a fantastic sight! When the baby whale returned them to the surface, little Nof and Maribel were greeted by flying fish. "The sea is an enchanted place," exclaimed Maribel. "I want to stay here forever," declared little Nof. Not wanting to be separated from his new friends, the baby whale shook his head as if to say yes. Back at the shore, the Nof said goodbye to their new friend. "Farewell, brave little whale," Maribel said. "Be happy," little Nof wished him. "Make sure to stay clear of fishing boats." As a farewell to thank the Nofs, the pod of whales performed their most spectacular feats. Baby whale leaped high out of the water for his very first time. Night fell gently and the sky filled with stars. "Tell me, little Nof, will you always be my friend?" "I promise," said little Nof. William Shakespeare, Twelfth Night. I am Fest the Fool, but that does not make me a fool. Quite the opposite. My job is to sing, dance, and make the Countess Olivia laugh, which I do very well. I am also the only person in beautiful Iria who knows what is going on and who is fooling whom. One night, a fierce storm brought two strangers to Illyria's shores. When I first saw her, Viola was lying exhausted on the beach, weeping for her beloved twin brother, Sebastian. Viola feared he had drowned, but I saw Sebastian swim safely ashore to the next beach. Viola thought it was wiser to pretend to be a young man than to go about as a young woman in an unknown country. She fashioned a false beard, dressed in her brother's clothes, and gave herself the name Cesario. She ventured into town to search for work. My job as the fool had become difficult because my mistress, Countess Olivia, had been very unhappy since the death of her father and brother. She dressed only in black, covered her beautiful face with a veil, and refused all visitors. She was the most desirable heiress in Iria, but had vowed never to marry because she was so sad. I was glad I was not Duke Orsino's fool because he was very sad too. He longed to make Olivia his wife, but she had rejected his letters of love and repeated offers of marriage. Orsino was handsome and rich and loved music and witty conversation. He would have been a very suitable husband for Olivia, but unless she could be persuaded to change her mind, it was not to be. He needed someone to help him. Olivia refused to see anyone other than me, her uncle, Sir Toby Belch, her maid, Maria, and her steward, Malvilio. So Orsino hired Cesaro, who was really Viola, to carry his desperate messages of love to Olivia. Cesario's gentle ways melted Olivia's cold heart, and she looked forward to his visits. Although Orsino pimp pined for Olivia. Cesario's charming conversation soothed his hurt feelings. The more time Orsino and Cesario spent together, the closer the two became until they were good friends. I could see that Cesario had fallen in love with his new friend, but Orsino, just like all the others, did not see through Cesario's disguise. I told you, Iria is full of fools. Luckily, not everyone was as gloomy as Olivia. My friend Sir Toby liked nothing better than singing, dancing, eating cakes, and drinking ale. Maria enjoyed Sir Toby's company because he was much more fun than her miserable mistress. Then there was foolish Sir Andrew Ogcheek. He had given Sir Toby lots of money to help him win Olivia's hand in marriage. I brought them all cheer with my singing. O mistress mine, where are you roaming? Oh, stay in here, your true love's coming. That can sing both high and low. Trip no further, pretty sweeting. Journeys end in lovers meeting. Every wise man's son doth know. One night, Malvio, the steward, stopped another of Sir Toby's noisy parties. He called us all mad and warned Sir Toby and Maria that he would tell Olivia of their wicked ways. Infuriated, Sir Toby vowed to pay Malvio back for ruining their fun. Malvio really was the most miserable man you could ever meet. He only wore black clothes, never smiled, and hated people having fun. No wonder he did not like Sir Toby. Malvio was jealous of Maria because she was clever and witty and spent her time with Olivia, whom he secretly adored. Malvio did not like me either, because as the fool, I can say and do what I want. I think it is better to be a witty fool like me than a foolish wit like him. All my singing, dancing, and fooling failed to cheer up Olivia, but when Cesario visited her, his witty conversation and gentle ways drew her out of her sadness. One day, Olivia lifted her veil to show Cesario her smiling face, and I could see that she had fallen in love with him. Poor Cesario! He was bringing messages of love from his master, whom he loved, to my mistress, who loved him. I wondered what would happen when Olivia and Orsino discovered that Cesario had fooled them both. Malvio was not as welcoming to Cesario as his mistress was. He could see how much Olivia liked Cesario, and that made him jealous. He had always dreamed of becoming closer to Olivia. One advantage of being the fool is that everyone tells me their secrets. I listened as Sir Toby and Maria plotted their revenge on Malvio. Maria had the idea of tricking Malvio into believing that Olivia loved him. Malvio was such a vain man, he would not doubt that this was true. Maria copied her mistress's handwriting and wrote a letter from Olivia to Malvio. The letter asked Malvio to show his love for Olivia by smiling broadly and wearing bright yellow cross-gartered stockings. I knew my mistress would hate all of this extravagance, especially as she was still in mourning. Malvio was very happy when he found the letter. He had not been born great or found greatness in his job, but now he believed that by marrying Olivia, greatness had been thrust upon him. He would become rich and powerful, no longer a servant, but a master. Malvio practiced walking like a lord and smiling as if he were already Olivia's husband. Little did he know that the letter was full of Maria's false words of love. We all thought Malvolio looked such a fool when he presented himself to Olivia. Malvolio's weird smiles frightened her, and his rambling words of love confused her. She thought he was unwell. Desperate for Malvolio to stop talking, Olivia asked Sir Toby to look after him. Seizing the moment, Sir Toby locked Malvolio in a dark cellar. He thought Malvolio deserved to be punished for all the unkindness he had shown over many years. It would be scary to be imprisoned in such a lonely place, where no one could hear your frightened cries for help. For the first time, I pitied Malvolio. Sir Toby wanted more fun. He persuaded Sir Andrew, who still longed for Olivia, to challenge his rival, Cesario, to a sword fight. Sir Toby knew that neither of them was a skilled swordsman, so they would both make fools of themselves. It was difficult to know which of the two was more scared. If Sir Andrew had realized he was fighting a young woman, I am sure he would have refused. The duel ended with both of them running away. Later that day, Sebastian, Cesario's twin brother, arrived, searching for his sister. Sir Andrew thought Sebastian was Cesario and started fighting him again. Silly Sir Andrew was in for a surprise because Sebastian was a skilled swordsman and knocked him down. Frightened, her beloved Cesario would be wounded. Olivia stopped the fight. She declared her love passionately to a bewildered Sebastian. Her beauty and kindness touched his heart, and he instantly fell in love with her. When Olivia suggested they marry, he quickly agreed. I had never seen my mistress so happy. But when the real Cesario met with Olivia and Orsino that afternoon, Olivia was puzzled by the way he was behaving. When she called Cesario her husband, Cesario thought she had gone mad. Olivia declared that Cesario was a cheat for denying they were married. Poor Orsino thought Cesario had betrayed him by marrying Olivia. It was difficult to know whom to feel sorrier for, as they were all so confused and upset. No one could believe their eyes when Sebastian suddenly appeared. What? Could there be two Cesarios? Olivia thought it was wonderful to have two very handsome husbands. Orsino thought he was seen double, and Sebastian and Cesario stared at each other in disbelief. Cesario realized that dear Sebastian had not drowned, threw off the disguise, and declared herself to be Viola, Sebastian's lost sister. Seeing Viola's true face for the first time, Orsino realized he loved her. Without hesitating, the Duke swore his love to Viola and asked her to be his wife. Everyone was shocked when Malvolio interrupted the celebrations. Gone was the pompous steward. A furious Malvolio accused Olivia of fooling him and treating him cruelly. But when Olivia read the letter, she told him he was the one who had been fooled by Sir Toby and Maria. Malvolio left the garden swearing he would be revenged on all of them. But Malvolio's threats could not spoil the happiness of the two couples, who could not take their eyes off each other. When Sir Toby saw the joy of the couples, he decided to marry his darling Maria. It is true that journeys end in lovers meeting. As you can see, while I play the fool, there are many people in this story who are fools themselves, and some who can fool others. I'm going to finish up the first half hour of today's program with Babar comes to America. In an airplane flying over Paris, Babar, king of the elephants, is on his way to the United States. The president has invited him for an official visit. When little Alexander said, "I would like to go to America too," Babar thought, "After all, why not?" And so, it has been decided that Queen Celeste and the children will come later and will join Babar in California. In just a few hours, the airplane is on the other side of the ocean. The stewardess announces, through the loudspeaker, "Ladies and gentlemen, we are approaching Dulles International Airport, Washington, D.C. Fasten your seat belts and please observe the no smoking sign." It is a very up-to-date airport. Traveling waiting rooms called mobile lounges, as comfortable as living rooms, carry passengers from the planes to the terminal building. Surrounded by reporters and photographers, Babar says a few words in English, but with a strong French accent. "I am very happy to come to your great country, the country of Washington, of Mark Twain, of Danny Kaye." That same evening, he has dinner with the president at the White House. Babar goes to see the Lincoln Memorial, then the Jefferson Memorial, and then the Capitol. It is all very tiring. Babar also visits the Washington Monument. After a few days, he has visited all the museums in the Capitol. Here he is, gazing at a rocket outside the Smithsonian Institution. "Do you have rockets like this in the country of the elephants?" someone asks. "Of course," answers Babar. "The first astronaut to set foot on the moon might well be an elephant." The official part of the trip is over. Babar is about to leave Washington to make a tour of the United States. So he packs away his crown and puts on a hat. Then he flies to New York, a city he has always wanted to see. Babar feels happy and very excited. As soon as he arrives, he goes for a walk on Park Avenue, but he gets something in his eye. This happens rather often in New York. Babar has spent a restful night in the Hilton Hotel. Seated in front of the window, he has his breakfast of orange juice, toast, cereal, and tea. Then he dresses quickly to go out. In the elevator, he swallows several times to keep his ears from hurting. The 40th floor is really very high. Babar takes a bus. The driver scolds him for putting a quarter into the fare box instead of 15 cents. At the bus stop, the doors stay shut. Babar is worried. "Step down," shouts the driver. Babar steps down and the doors open automatically. A few seconds more, and I would have been trapped, Babar thinks. Then he goes for a stroll in Central Park. On the streets of New York, everyone seems to be in a hurry. No one looks at anyone else. And the moment the traffic light turns green, the auto horns all honk at once. What a racket! Walking always makes Babar hungry. He goes into a drugstore. He can't decide which to order, a hamburger or a cheeseburger. Finally, he takes both. It is just as difficult to choose something to drink. He wants to try everything: Coca-Cola, Pepsi-Cola, V8, 7-Up, ginger ale, all of them. Finally, for dessert, he orders apple pie a la mode. But he samples a banana split and a chocolate soda too. And then he doesn't feel very well. He has eaten too much. To buy something for his stomach ache, he just walks over to another counter in the same store. Drugstores are certainly convenient. It's too bad that there aren't any in the country of the elephants. Now Babar continues his walk. He is looking for a jewelry store that has been recommended to him, but the store is gone. A new 50-story building is being built there. Suddenly, Babar says to himself, "I've forgotten where I'm supposed to meet my friends, Bob and Helen." He telephones them. "We will pick you up at your hotel at 7 o'clock, Helen says. They take him to a Japanese restaurant. Babar is delighted with it. He takes off his shoes like everyone else. Babar tells his friends that he has bought a brass rooster in an antique shop. Later in the evening, they go to Greenwich Village to hear Theodorious Priest and his quartet. Bob asks, "Do you like jazz?" "Very much," says Babar. Babar spends a quiet weekend in Scarsdale with his friends and their children, Peter, Tommy, Billy, and the dog, Sadie. Babar learns to play baseball. What strength! And he doesn't even need a glove to catch the ball. "It's not fair," says little Billy. "Would you like to go to the supermarket with me?" asks Helen. "With pleasure," answers Babar, "and I will push the shopping cart." But he has a hard time following Helen as she quickly makes her way through the aisles. Babar takes home some popcorn for Peter, Tommy, and Billy. "This way, I'm over here," she calls to him, forgetting that he is so big. Babar knocks over a gallon of cider. The bottle breaks. There is quite a traffic jam. Babar is very upset. "It's not important," Helen says to console him. In the evening, they watch a baseball game on television. Babar has spent a whole evening preparing for the rest of his trip and deciding which places to visit. He goes to Boston and then to Harvard University nearby. Babar is awarded the degree of Doctor of Letters, a great honor. The professors present him with his diploma and his hood. Then Babar visits the office of the Lampoon, the student magazine. He promises to send the students photographs from the country of the elephants. Babar continues on his tour. Here he is in Detroit, inspecting an automobile factory. It is certainly fascinating to learn how cars are made. First, there is only a block of red-hot steel. It is cut up and shaped into many parts, and then everything is put together on the assembly line. Suddenly, Babar hears someone shout, "Watch out, Mr. Elephant!" Too late, his hat is gone. Babar admires Chicago, especially the Merchandise Mart and the Marriott Towers. Here, he is on State Street. On Sunday, some friends take Babar fishing on the shores of Lake Michigan. There are a great many people. They all have fishing rods, picnic lunches, barbecue grills, and even television sets. Babar settles down to fish. For a long time, he must be patient. It really seems that there are no fish. Still nothing. Oops! There is one on his hook. But to serve for lunch, it is rather small. "You won't starve, Babar," his friend Lena says. "I have brought a steak." In fact, no one beside the lake is eating fish. Everywhere are barbecue grills with skewered meat and spare ribs. Babar broils the steak like a real chef. After lunch, he plays with Lena's little boy, Adrian. Babar continues his trip west. The train takes him across the Rocky Mountains. Babar rides in the Vesta Dome car so that he can admire the view and take photographs. Babar arrives at the hotel in San Francisco. "There he is!" shout Palm, Flora, Alexander, and Cousin Arthur, who have been hiding on the staircase. "Papa! Babar!" The manager welcomes Babar, and the children take him to his room, where Celeste is waiting. Babar kisses her tenderly. Then Flora and Alexander jump into his lap, insisting, "Tell us about your trip." Babar tells them about everything he has done since his arrival in Washington. Then he goes out to see the Golden Gate Bridge. Unfortunately, it is hidden by fog. Babar must go back 3 times before the weather is clear. "This bridge is as beautiful as a cathedral," he thinks to himself. This is how a family of elephants rides on a cable car to keep it from tipping over. Celeste and Flora have taken a taxi because women are not permitted to ride on the outside of the cable car. On Telegraph Hill, Alexander has a naughty idea. Why don't we put on our roller skates, he suggests. Babar and Celeste are just wondering where Arthur, Pom, and Alexander have gone when they suddenly appear, rolling down the street at full speed. A policeman catches them and warns them not to do it again. Babar is sketching on Fisherman's Wharf. Pom, who has come with him, suddenly begins to cry. My stomach hurts, he moans. Babar carries Pom back to the hotel on his shoulder. The little elephant is still crying. Celeste calls the doctor. My child, says the doctor, taking Pom's pulse, you have eaten too much lobster. That's all there is to it. Pom has to take bad-tasting medicine, and he grumbles a little, but he wants to get well, so he does what he is told. On Thanksgiving, Bob and Helen invite Babar and his family to join them for dinner. They ask the king of the elephants if he will carve the turkey. Celeste is hurrying to buy some last-minute gifts. As she passes the hat department, she cannot resist the temptation to choose a new one for herself. And now it is time to pack and to say goodbye. Babar, Celeste, Arthur, Pom, Flora, and Alexander are returning to the country of the elephants. They are sad about leaving, but they hope to see their friends again someday. On the deck of the ship, watching the tall buildings fade slowly into the distance, they carry with them the memories of their wonderful trip to America. And this is just a reminder. My name is Andy Bombeck, and I hope you're enjoying the Children's Story Hour. And as I mentioned at the beginning of today's program, for the second half hour, I'm going to continue reading the novel that I just started last week, titled Too Bright to See. 11-year-old Bug is used to haunted things. After all, the occasional cold spot or mysteriously slamming door is to be expected when your house is almost as old as the dirt it sits on. But when a new presence makes itself known the summer before Bug starts middle school, it's clear that this spirit is intent on communicating something directly to Bug. But what and why? As Bug begins to untangle the mystery of this new ghost, an altogether different truth tugs free. It's the answer to a question of identity, one Bug never even thought to ask. Okay, last week, Chapter 1, we learned Bug lives in a very old house with her mom and her uncle, Rodnick, who just died. She believes the old house is haunted. Chapter 2. Mom and Uncle Roderick and I rattled around our house like peas in an oversized pod. Sometimes we would have house guests from New York City or Burlington or Montreal, filling it up with noise and laughter and memories. But the three of us could fill it up just as well. Tonight the house is full of people and memories, but not much laughter. Family friends have come from all over. But not many people from our little pocket of Vermont show up. We moved here when I was a baby, and old Vermonters don't acknowledge you until there's six in the ground. Six dead people, they mean, in a row, stretching back through the years. Well, we've got our first. But Uncle Roderick isn't even in the ground. Not really. He didn't want a funeral, he said, or a burial. Just sprinkle my ashes on the land, he told us toward the end. We did, putting handfuls in the creek, the woods, the garden, everywhere. Mom says that everyone deserves a chance to say goodbye. I wish they could say goodbye somewhere else. The house has never been this full before, and I can't go hide with Uncle Roderick in his room. I have to wear this dress that makes me look like Samantha from the American Girl books. It's rumpled from being at the bottom of my closet for months, and Uncle Roderick usually took care of the ironing. People pat me on the shoulder or hug me, and since I'm the one with a dead uncle, it's okay that I don't hug back. My dress is like a force field. It blocks out the pressure of their hands or arms around me. which is good because if I actually feel anyone touch me, I'll break apart into smithereens. In between, I focus on tightening my ponytail and tugging at the wrinkles in my dress. It's too small for me, and if I hunch forward, the material pulls across my back, keeping me a gasp away from a full breath. Conversations pause if I walk by them, but tucked into a corner of the living room, I catch snatches here and there. Awfully young. He was only 32, right? It's so sad, especially since Sabrina's husband died right after she gave birth. A car accident, if I'm remembering correctly. No, they don't have anyone else. This place started out as a vacation home, and it's been in their family for a while, but no one else is left. One of Uncle Roderick's ex-boyfriends is across the room, down from Portland. I think his name is Tobias. He's tall and thin, like Uncle Roderick, but with a shaved head and a beard. He was nice, but had wanted kids, and my uncle decided that I was enough kid for him. So they broke up but stayed friends. Tobias catches my eye and gives me a small, sad smile. I turn up the corners of my mouth in what might be a smile and skitter away before he can come over to shake my hand or hug me or pay whatever respects he has. I duck into the kitchen, but catch my dress on the door frame. I reach down to tug it away from a nail or whatever. It's not stuck on anything, but there's a rip that I don't think was there before. Oh well, I'm getting too big for it anyway. No one else is in the kitchen, their dishes cluttered on the wide wooden counter, crusted with food. So I dump them in the sink and turn on the faucet. I've always begged Mom for a dishwasher, especially since I only just got tall enough to reach the bottom of the huge sink. But right now, scrubbing at dishes in hot soapy water quiets the jangling in my brain. I start planning out what I need to pack for summer camp and have gotten into a rhythm of washing and rinsing when I look up at the window behind the sink. A strange face stares back at me, darkly reflected in the glass. I yelp, jump back, and a glass slips out of my hand and crashes onto the kitchen floor. A second later, the kitchen door swings open. "You okay, Bug?" a voice calls out. Mo, my best or oldest or only friend. She and her mom showed up a while ago, but I haven't said hi yet. The dress is still pulling on my back and shoulders. "Fine," I say. I can't figure out how to get my mouth to say more than that. I grab at a broom and dustpan to hide my shaking hands. This happens a lot. I'll be minding my own business in the bathroom or kitchen or whatever and catch a glimpse of something in the mirror that isn't me. Not a blood-dripping evil face or anything obviously supernatural. Just a face that isn't quite mine. Almost mine, but different enough that it gives me a shock every time. Another part of living in a haunted house, I guess, except it doesn't happen only when I'm at home. Mo always makes me swear that she won't get attacked by ghosts when she spends the night at my house. I always promise, but that's because ghosts don't attack people, don't notice people even. They're in their own world, whatever that is, and we're in this one. The only times we overlap are like how if you look into a bright light for too long, you see it even after you look away, even when you close your eyes. It's not in front of you, but it still leaves an impression. Mo has never even seen one of those. She's scared of coming across a tall woman in a blood-stained wedding gown or a pale little boy with a bad smile, but doesn't notice when her hair is caught in a non-existent breeze or a room's mood shifts while it remembers something. I don't tell her when it happens because Mo's the only person who's willing to sleep over in the first place. I finish sweeping and lean back against the kitchen island. Mo hops onto it next to me. I can tell she's struggling to come up with something to say. She always has something to say, and right now I don't want to listen, but it's nice, or something, of her to try. "Where did that dress come from?" she asked finally. "I've never seen it before." Well, it's better than asking how I'm doing. There's no good answer. I wonder if she knows better than to ask that, or if she's actually curious about the dress. I'd rather not talk about anything. Just moving my mouth feels hard, but I don't want Mo to start chattering away, which is what she usually does, if I don't keep up my end of a conversation. I don't remember. It's old. My voice surprises me. It sounds normal. Mom said I might need a dress for some occasion. I look like my old Samantha doll. Ha, yeah, you do. I still have my Felicity somewhere. Remember when we would make up whole stories with them? Yours always involved pirates or kidnappings or something. I always wanted to take them to balls. And then we would compromise. Pirate ball or glamorous kidnapped princess. I just nod and look down at the puffy skirt. It really does look more like a costume than a dress. Mo looks like she's going to a funeral instead of our house, in a smooth dark skirt and matching top. Her bright red hair is in a tight braid, not loose and frizzy like normal. She's a few months younger than me, but she looks almost like an adult today, almost like a woman. I just look like a doll, quiet, stiff, and blinking. "We have to go," she says after a minute of silence. "I just came in to say goodbye. I'll see you soon, though, and I'm so sorry." She leans in to hug me, and I manage to lift my arms and squeeze her back for a second before it becomes too much. She's always been the type to put her arms around her other friends, play with their hair, a casual affection that has always seemed impossible to me. I'm not sure how bodies are supposed to interact. I feel like I'm hugging a scarecrow, or more that I'm a scarecrow being hugged. Mo gives me an awkward pat on the back before pushing her shoulder against the swinging kitchen door. Her skirt doesn't catch on anything. I go back to the sink and start washing dishes again. The kitchen has always been my favorite room in the house. It's where I watched Uncle Roderick bake cookies and can vegetables, experiment with new recipes. And it's kind in here, safe. I imagine what I must look like, a girl with long hair pulled back, a torn dress scrubbing away like a servant girl in a royal palace, and thinking about that girl and imagining her life keeps me distracted from what is actually happening. The soapy water has gone cold, and I finish up without looking at the window again. Chapter 3. Some guests stay for a few days after the memorial. I make myself useful, dodging questions about how I'm holding up by doing endless loads of dishes and laundry. I pretend to be a character in a book, sometimes an abused but brilliant servant girl, sometimes a spy at a seedy hotel, sometimes a princess mistaken for a commoner. It's fun, kind of. It's something I've always done. Girls in books always seem more real than real life. And making believe that I'm in a story keeps my mind off of what I really am, which isn't much. It takes a couple days, but finally everyone goes back to where they live. Big cities for most of them. I was born in Brooklyn, but Mom moved us here when I was only a few months old. After my dad died, she says she didn't know how to stop one life, married, no kids, and start a new one, widowed kid, without going all the way, without making another huge change. Uncle Roderick came with her. "I never thought it was going to be permanent," he told me last year, while we were picking blueberries. He used them in a pie later, but I was eating mine right off the bush. We would vacation up here when we were kids, but neither of us had any reason to stay in Vermont. I thought we'd spend a couple years, she'd heal from the loss of your dad, and then we'd go back. But kids root you to a place. It's like we grew down into this earth instead of growing up from it. The biggest city I've been to is Burlington. On a school field trip, I learned that Burlington is the smallest, biggest, the biggest city in the state, and the smallest city with that distinction. It felt huge to me. People everywhere I looked, stores on top of stores on top of stores. Uncle Roderick talked about bringing me to New York, but we never made it. I don't think I'll ever visit now. It's morning. The house is empty of everyone except Mom and me. And I'm staring at Uncle Roderick's carved wooden tea cabinet perched below the spice rack, drying for a cuppa, like they say in old books from England. I don't know any other 11-year-olds who drink tea, but Uncle Roderick started making it for me, mostly honey and milk, once I graduated from sippy cups. I know there's a half-full drawer of jasmine in there, and I miss the weight of a heavy mug warming my hands. The comfort of sipping at something hot and sweet, but I can't bring myself to boil water, ease open the rickety drawer, measure leaves into a tea ball, steep it properly. Too many steps. I pour myself a glass of juice instead and fix a bowl of cereal. Mom shuffles in, still wearing her robe, looking like she hasn't slept for weeks. Thank you for being so helpful these past few days, sweetheart, she says, her voice thick with sleep or grief or both. You'd make a great scullery maid. I know, I mumble. My throat closes around any other words. Normally, we'd launch into some conversation about what chores you wouldn't want to do in a medieval castle. Or I'd go into some dramatic monologue about working my fingers to the bone. But there isn't any laughter in me, and it wouldn't be the same without Uncle Roderick joining in, with a terrible attempt at an English accent or pretending to be better than me because he's a chambermaid. I stir my spoon around the bowl, and Mom slips out to get the newspaper from the porch. There's not much laughter in her either, and I know she only tried for me. When she comes back, she tosses the comics page down on the counter in front of me and makes herself some coffee. She's never been much of a tea drinker, and I'm grateful for that. I stare at the comics, not actually reading them. Smiling seems like it would hurt, like clay has dried in my cheeks and a twitch of my lips would crack it off. A prickling at the back of my eyes makes me look up. Mom has the paper spread out in front of her, but she's looking at me like she has more bad news. She swallows hard when I meet her gaze. There are new lines etched around the corners of her mouth, and her eyes are red. I know we planned on sending you to camp again in July, she begins softly, and I want to tell her to stop. I know where this is going. But she has that sad half-smile on her face that I've seen a lot this past year, so I let her keep going. Mom and Uncle Roderick look so much alike, with shaggy, dirty blonde hair, green eyes, and pointy chins. My skin tans while their paler skin burns. I have bluer eyes, a bigger nose, dark hair. My dad had dark hair. I keep mine long because it never needs cutting that way. I grab the base of my ponytail and squeeze, the pull on my scalp helping a little. Well, your uncle's insurance covered a lot of his medical bills. But that last place he was in, the hospice, was very expensive. I don't want you to worry. We're not going to starve. But I'm afraid there isn't much extra cash lying around. I promise I'll do everything I can to help you have a fun summer. but camp is out of the question this year. Hopefully, next year will be different. I'm so sorry, Bug. At camp, we sleep in a hayloft and gather eggs for breakfast. We play endless games of capture the flag and hide and seek, go on midnight walks, canoe in the lake, everything. I'm not great at making friends, but something about the comforting, consistent bad food, whole day games of tag, the rainy days when we climb the rock wall in the gym, bringing us all together in a way that school can't. Kids come from all over New England, and it's the only time in the year where I feel part of a larger group. I've gone every July since I was 6 and stayed for the entire month, the past 2 years. I loved Uncle Roderick, and I loved camp. Now I don't have either. It's okay, I say. It isn't, but it is. I should have guessed, after going with Mom to visit Uncle Roderick in the hospital. All those treatments and medicines couldn't have been cheap. And he hadn't worked for a long time, not since he got really sick. Mom has always been honest with me, and talking about money is part of that. I can't whine about missing camp when I understand why. Besides, if I show Mom how upset I am, it will only make her feel worse, which won't make anything better. The cereal in my bowl is completely soggy now. There is no way I can finish it. I had only eaten one spoonful anyway. I shove aside my barely touched breakfast and unread comics and tell Mom that I'm going outside. She pulls me into her arms as I walk past her, holding me tight. I don't want to be hugged right now, but I know that this hug is for her. That I have to show her that I'm not mad, so I squeeze her until she lets go. Only then do I take a deep breath. It's a beautiful day. We own a lot of the land around my house. The backyard is a big grassy field, and beyond that is a patch of woods I've explored ever since I could walk. A creek runs through the woods, and I can spend entire days reading on a boulder near the water or splashing around trying to catch minnows. Uncle Roderick would walk through the woods with me and tell stories of the gnomes and fairies hiding just out of sight, or point out edible plants and poisonous berries. We would pack a picnic lunch and find shapes in the clouds, sit quiet and still, and wait for snakes and squirrels to come out around us. It never felt lonely. He would sometimes joke about the big city life he left behind, glamorous and loud and bright. But he loved filling our big house with restored antiques and chopping wood for winter fires. My bike is stashed under the porch. I pull it out, brush a spider off the handlebar, and climb on. I pedal away from my house, trying to get up enough speed to catch the wind between my teeth. Then I remember Uncle Roderick teaching me how to ride, putting bandages on my knees and elbows when I fell. I remember following him into town on crisp fall days to visit the farmer's market. I remember him showing me how to change the tire, our hands greasy and black and smelling like rubber and the earth. Something blunt and unstoppable tries to push its way up from my stomach, into my throat, and beyond my eyes. I break sharply, jump off, and walk back home, leaving my bike sprawled on the side of the dirt road, one wheel still spinning forlornly. I go to bed early that night, too sad to stay awake. I'm fast asleep until all at once I'm not. It's like the night he died all over again, except instead of a sudden lack, a cold nothing, where there was once a warm someone, now there's something else. My eyes are still shut tight, but someone is in my room. Her eyes were shut tight, I say in my head like a narrator, wondering what a girl in a book would do. She knew it was just her imagination. I try opening them just barely and peeking through my eyelashes, but it's so dark. Dark enough that if I open my eyes a little more, I'll still be safe. I hope. I squint them open a crack more and see it. It? Him? Her? A tall, thin, dark shape looming in front of my closed door. Is it a shadow? Is it moving? I'm silent. I'm so, so silent. It can't know I'm awake. I'm not even breathing. And then I realize that I've stopped breathing. Sleep breaths are long and slow and steady. And it knows I'm awake now. I see it, him, moving toward me. And quickly as anything, I flip on the light next to my bed. I don't know if I want to see, but light will help no matter what. And nothing is there. It's not the first time I've been scared in my house at night, but it's the first time I can't scream and know what my uncle will come running. When I was very little, I had lots of nightmares. Mom doesn't wake up for anything, but Uncle Roderick would be by my side right away, talking me through it. He'd ask what I thought it meant, if it represented something I was afraid of in real life, what the dream was trying to tell me. And in discussing, it would fade from memory, completely forgotten in the morning. I want to call for him now and know that he would come in, sit on the side of my bed, and tell me that ghosts are nothing to be afraid of. That they don't even know we're here. That we're not even in the same world. But he's resting now at peace, and I can't help but think that this one felt different. It wasn't in another world. It knew I was there, and it knew I was awake. But I don't know what it wanted, and I don't know why it left. After that, I can only sleep in fits and starts. But by morning, I've almost managed to convince myself that it was only a dream. And even if it wasn't a dream, even if there was something, some spirit in my room, it wasn't really all that different from the wandering ghosts that are always whooshing around my house. They've never even paid attention to me. They've never hurt me before. And unfortunately, that's all the time that we have for today. I hope that everyone enjoyed today's program as much as I did. I want to say hi to all the listeners out there, and I want to encourage everyone to tune in next week when I continue with the novel, Too Bright to See. Until then, I hope everyone has a great day and a fast and fantastic week. So long and take care, everyone. Goodbye.